In 1776, 56 men stepped up to the front of the room in Philadelphia's Independence Hall and put their name on the document that would make America, America. And of those 56 men, there's some bold-faced names we're all pretty familiar with. There's John Adams of Massachusetts, who would be the second president. There's Benjamin Franklin, who would go on to do, well, all kinds of things. And there was, of course, the man who put the words to paper, Thomas Jefferson of Virginia. Also in that Continental Congress were three men from Georgia. Three men tasked with representing the budding nation's youngest colony. There was Button Gwinnett, who we talked about back in episode one of this podcast. There was George Walton, an attorney who was also once a prisoner of war, held captive by the British, and would briefly serve as governor and senator. And there was Dr. Lyman Hall, educated at Yale, a primary figure of the Southern delegation during the Continental Congress, and portrayed in the 1972 musical film, 1776.
Excuse me.
Yes?
I'm Dr. Lyman Hall, the new delegate from Georgia.
I'm Andrew McNair, congressional custodian.
Where does the Georgia delegation belong?
Oh, they mill about over there in that corner, near the two Carolinas.
Most of these men will wind up with their names all over things. Buildings, universities. George Walton and Lyman Hall certainly have their share, counties and schools. And of all the markers we've visited for this series, the Signer's Monument is truly unique. Because in downtown Augusta, it was not only built to recognize these three men, but it also serves another purpose. In 1848, the remains of George Walton and Lyman Hall were both exhumed and brought to Augusta, where they were buried once again. There at the monument, at the historical marker, just below Green Street. Welcome to the Marked Podcast. Across Georgia, there's more than 2,000 historical markers that tell the story of a person, place, or an event from our state's past. And our digital video series explores a select few of those from Georgia's revolutionary history. And in this podcast, we're expanding on that with additional voices to help bring out the stories of these markers and the context of what they tell us about our state. Hello and welcome to Marked the Podcast. I'm Andrew Iden, the executive producer of the Marked Project here at GPB. And I'm pleased to be joined by two well-qualified experts today. Our first guest is Dr. Leanne Caldwell. She's a professor emerita of history at Augusta University and the director of the university's Center for the Study of Georgia History. She spent decades researching Georgia's revolutionary past, has served as president of the Georgia Association of Historians, and earned her PhD in history from the University of Georgia. Dr. Caldwell, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Our second guest is Ransom Schwarzler, director of Meadow Garden in Augusta, the historic home of George Walton. She has spent the past 8 years researching Walton's life and legacy, has also served as a docent and trustee there, and she holds a degree in history from Auburn University. Ransom, thanks for being here.
Hello.
So let's start with Lyman Hall, because on paper, he's probably the least likely person you'd expect to become one of Georgia's signers of the Declaration of Independence. So who was he?
Well, Lyman Hall was basically a Congregationalist from New England. He was the son of a pastor from New England, John Hall. His wife's father was a pastor. He was kin on his mother's side to the Yales, who founded Yale University. He got a degree from Yale and was a pastor himself for a number of years. But like some other New England, and I hesitate to use the word Puritan as late as the 1750s, but that's certainly what they were the descendants of those original Puritans who came to New England from England as to set up the church the way they thought it should be. And the most of these Puritans were what were called non-separating Puritans. Their original idea was they're going to reform the Church of England from the inside. The exception to that were the Pilgrims who founded Plymouth, who were separating Puritans. They wanted to separate out from the Church of England altogether. So that's his tradition. It's very interesting because the New Englanders, among other things, their religious belief was that everyone had to be able to read the Bible. And if everyone had to be able to read the Bible, everyone had to be able to read. And so there's a tradition of education in New England that you don't necessarily see in other parts of the colonies, especially of non-elites. You know, even in Virginia and the other southern colonies, the elites are going to become educated. But in New England, there's this real tradition of education. And in a lot of ways, Lyman Hall reflects that. He married twice. His first wife died within a year of their marriage. They had no children. He married again. And he and his second wife in the 1750s moved to Dorchester, South Carolina, which is an interesting story in itself because it was founded by a group of Puritans from New England in the late 1600s who thought they were running out of land and space up there, and so they came and settled in South Carolina. From South Carolina, a number of these people then came to Georgia. And settled in Midway, Georgia, which was midway between Savannah and the coastal areas of Darien and what today is Brunswick, that whole area down there. And so there he began to practice medicine. He had studied medicine after he left the pastorate, and he practiced medicine first in South Carolina, in Dorchester, and then in Georgia. And was evidently a competent for that time, as much as they knew about medicine at that time, some of which we know today is not very accurate.
One of the things that struck me while researching this episode specifically is that neither of these men was actually born in Georgia, right? Both came here looking for opportunity. And in a lot of ways, that becomes the story of revolutionary Georgia itself. But honestly, that begs the question, why Georgia?
It was young, and there was a lot of opportunity for aspiring young people. The other thing that drew many people first to Savannah and then later to other places is there were two cessions of land from the indigenous people, from the Creeks, in 1763 and 1773. And so all of this backcountry area was opening up and people could get grants of land. And so that is going to draw some people in as well. And I think both of our gentlemen we're talking about today, that's part of it. Because certainly Lyman Hall could have done well staying in Dorchester, which is very near Charleston. But he's drawn with these other Puritans to this land in east central Georgia. And I think probably Walton has some of the same things. So there, for Walton too, and for Hall, there aren't that many professional people in Georgia at this time. So there's a real opportunity to have a practice of either of those professions in the young colony. You know, all of the three signers from Georgia were non-native to Georgia. None of our people had been born in the colony that became the state that rebelled. So that says something about the youth of the colony itself. Remember, we're only 40-something years old at this point.
Ransom, how about when George gets to Savannah and he's, you know, he kind of sets up shop, I guess, literally and figuratively as an attorney. What do we know about sort of his rise in the community, both professionally and as sort of like a leader and kind of a prominent voice of the time?
He definitely, again, makes the most of every opportunity. He comes, again, as to read the law, as a student in the law. He will apprentice with a lawyer named Henry Young. And he will study with Mr. Young Esquire in those early days. And we kind of contrast this against our, George was only 26 when he signed the Declaration. There were two other signers who were 26, both from South Carolina, both lawyers. They both studied in England and they studied law in the Inns of Court. They had a very different path to the law than George did. So George came down, found this opportunity with a lawyer. He would study with that lawyer. And obviously, again, he is finding every way to connect through that early, through early Georgia. Two of his brothers will also migrate, will come here to Georgia. They probably are taking advantage of those land grants. We see John Walton here in Augusta, where we are today. We see John here in Augusta with property by about 1769. He's one of George's older brothers. George's brother Robert also will come, and a bunch of those 13 cousins end up here as well. There are a lot of Waltons in this area by the time we're all done. But George, he starts building. He's studying with this lawyer. And we can look at the fees that are related to different legal matters. Then as now, there's a fee for everything. And you can look at those fees to see how much work everyone's getting and what they're doing. And within just a couple years after George does the equivalent of passing the bar, he has to take an oath to the king in 1774 in order to practice law. We're still a colony. And this young man, he's taken an oath to the king to be able to do his job. And then he goes down to Tondi's Long Room. He goes down to this tavern and starts talking about how unfair all this British stuff is. That's all weaving together. And he is making connections. I think when he is first elected as a delegate, it is from not where he is resident. It is from one of the outlying areas where he has connections with some of the merchants. I think it's Telfair is a big connection of his. One of those merchants that's not right there, that's kind of a little out of town. And he's got connections to the back country with his brother, John. And he's
a politician who's running for office in a place where he doesn't live. Sorry,
and
I couldn't help myself.
There he is. And he's weaving together all of these different connections. And I feel like we get such a picture of him because he has to seem incredibly responsible. He has to be terribly charismatic. I mean, people are trusting him with their legal matters when he's so young. He's getting people to, you know, he's making these connections and getting people to come along with the things he's talking about from such a young age. He had to have had quite a force of personality to be able to do this again at 25, 26 years old at this point, when he dives into that revolutionary effort, those Friends of America, in a really real way.
One of the things I think that's interesting about both of these men specifically is that their stories sort of are different in a couple ways, right? Hall arrives, he's got education, he's got connections. Walton gets to Georgia with almost none of that. But at the end of the day, both of them wind up signing this incredibly formative document, the document in American history.
Well, Lyman Hall's story is a little bit different because he's really part of this Congregationalist community that has settled in Midway together. And he brings his New England ideas down with him. And remember, the New Englanders are the first people to really begin to protest a lot of what's going on. And if you look at the action of the American Revolution, a lot of it's up in the North. When the Intolerable Acts are passed, they're punishing Boston for the Boston Tea Party. Lyman Hall still has relatives there. So it's very personal to him what's going on in his community. Lyman Hall is also twice as old as George Walton. He was 52 in 1776 when he signed. And he was one of four physicians that signed the Declaration of Independence, the very famous one being Dr. Benjamin Rush in Pennsylvania. But Georgia is small enough that if you're part of a professional kind of elite group, you know the merchants, you know these other people, in your own place and in Savannah and in Augusta. They knew some of the people in Augusta as well, which is one of the other big settlements. And then, of course, you've got the Lackland McIntoshes and people like that down in the Darien area, but they all knew each other. One of the interesting things to me about Walton and Hall and Button Gwinnett is they're part of a faction of revolutionaries that have a little bit different idea of how this thing should go and what should happen. Almost 100 years ago, a historian named Carl Becker said the American Revolution was about home rule. In other words, not being ruled by Britain, and about who was going to rule at home. And these three men who signed the Declaration were part of a more, some people call them radicals, but they were a more progressive group in the sense that they wanted a more democratic society. They more people able to vote, more people able to participate in the process. And so they're in a lot of ways working together. And some of the people that they're not necessarily in agreement with who are revolutionaries are the Savannah elite. So the Havershams and Joneses and people like that.
Hall's path into the revolution was shaped by where he came from. George Walton's story was very different.
We kind of follow his letters. He picks up a letter to, interestingly, I believe I've got a reference to a letter, and I haven't found the letter yet, that he will deliver from Lackland McIntosh to Button Gwinnett. So we know he picks that letter up in May. There's another letter that he delivers from Archibald Bullock to I believe it's John Adams, which arrives the last week of June. So he is also enlisted as he goes up from Georgia to go up to the Continental Congress. He is also on that trek stopping to recruit soldiers because Georgia does not have a whole lot in the way of troops. And so one of his jobs as he goes up the Eastern Seaboard is to try to convince and pay people to come down to Georgia to fight with us. So he is doing that, making advantage of his connections with that family from Virginia, and he will recruit his way through North Carolina and Virginia, particularly up the Eastern Seaboard as he goes along when he goes up. But you mentioned the arrest of the royal governor. That was January of 1776. We have just passed sort of last summer, we were passing those anniversaries of George sort of jumping in, putting his name on some announcements for people to come and talk about these issues. When they have that provincial Congress in July of 1775, he's the secretary of that Congress. This young man is taking a leadership role. He's on all the committees. George cannot say no to anybody. He seems very idealistic. And he's, again, this is giving him opportunities to move up in society in ways that he probably wouldn't have had otherwise. And he's taking advantage of that. He joins the big Masonic Lodge. And by December, he is elected president of the Council of Safety. This 25, maybe 26-year-old man, in January, they make that resolution to arrest the royal governor. We haven't even gotten to that vote for independence. But Georgia has really moved itself out from under British rule at that moment when these young men start taking that control of this colony that's on its way to becoming a state from their royal governor and that generation that is his peers. It's moving to some of those much younger voices that are, I think, at this point, very idealistic. I think George gets distilled down where he probably becomes more radicalized through some of these battles and other things as he goes along, as the more he sees. But at this point, this is this bright young man that's like, yes, I want to do everything, and off he goes. They arrest the royal governor, and he stays back a little longer after the others go up. But he in a letter to John Adams, he said he heard John Adams sum up John Adams makes a summation, and we don't have that, I don't believe, in its full form on July 1st. And George speaks of, in a letter to Adams, of hearing him and it inspiring his life and service. So obviously made an impression.
By the summer of 1776, both men had arrived in Philadelphia by very different roads. But they were about to become linked forever.
We talk a lot about Congress here, so let's avoid some confusion, okay? First, there is the provincial Congress, and that's state level. Think Golden Dome. And then there's the Continental Congress. That's federal. Independence Hall, Philadelphia. And there's actually two of those.
The first Continental Congress only lasted about 2 months, from early September to late October 1774. And it's held in Philadelphia's Carpenter's Hall. The second Continental Congress runs from May 1775 all the way to late spring 1781. And this is the one most of us are familiar with. And like Button Gwinnett, George Walton served in both the Georgia Provincial Congress and the Second Continental Congress. And it's that Second Continental Congress where all three of them, Gwinnett, Hall, and Walton, pretty much become linked for life, because they are the three Georgians that will put their signatures on the Declaration of Independence.
Ransom, let me ask you, beyond their signing of the Declaration of Independence for both of these guys, what to you really stands out about the George Walton story? And what is sort of the thing that people need to understand about what he contributed to Georgia?
Well, and George, while Button Gwinnett and Lyman Hall come back to Georgia fairly quickly after signing the Declaration, relatively so, George will stay for a year and a half. And he will stay quite literally in Philadelphia for that year and a half. So in December, when, you know, Washington's been defeated in New York, they're in retreat, and everybody is thinking that General Howe was going to march on Philadelphia for a time. They were sure he was going to take the rebel capital, war will be over by the end of the year. Congress picks up and moves in December of 1776. They light out and head for, I think it's Baltimore, Maryland, where they'll reconvene December 20th, I believe. And three men stay behind: George Walton, Lyman Hall, and George Walton, Robert Morris, and George Clymer are the three men who stay behind. Clymer and Morris are both from there in Philadelphia, and we see Robert Morris, who is really one of the often referred to as the financier of the revolution. He is of an elevated social level. He is everything that is money and power and position. And, you know, this is probably what George is aspiring to. And he seems to be quite a mentor for our George. But George stays there in Philadelphia. He is part of that committee that is appointed to take care of the business of the Congress in Philadelphia. He is, again, taking advantage of every opportunity to learn and grow and do more. He'll come back down to Georgia. He has also been moving up in the military all this time. He is also a soldier. And by January of 1778, he is the colonel of the 1st Georgia Regiment. So he will, through that year, he gets married and takes care, you know, restarts his law practice, gets married. He's pretty busy in 1778. But by the end of that year, he fights in the first siege of Savannah. We are horribly outnumbered. I think there's about 3,000 British troops coming into Savannah by sea, maybe 700 or 800 members of those Georgia forces. It is an awful, awful defeat. In his obituary, they refer to it, he survived the storm of Savannah. During that battle, he's shot in the leg. He's captured. He's held as a prisoner of war for 10 months. He's the highest ranking prisoner of war, so they take care of his wound. They don't amputate his leg, but he does have a musket ball in his leg for the rest of his life. Once he's released, he sends his young wife that he just married not a year before, sends her up to stay with family in Charleston. She's captured by the British. So he puts her on a ship. It encounters a storm the first night out at sea. The British capture that ship. They move the passengers onto a British ship, the Guadalupe. That ship will then be blown off course. Dorothy Walton, wife of the signer of the Declaration, is then held captive by the British for about 4 or 5 months down in Antigua, in that British stronghold. George, once he is released, he goes back to his unit to fight. But he's then, after that, twice governor of Georgia. He's the chief justice of Georgia. He's a circuit court judge, which means riding 100 miles a year, remembering the musket ball in his leg while he's doing all of this, mind you. He served in all three branches of government and the military. He served his at the local, state, and national level for the rest of his life, pretty much. He's kind of reminds us that there are a lot, you know, you talk about the movie 1776, which I haven't seen in a long, long time. But we kind of get that idea that just those big marquee figures were involved. You know, if you didn't eventually become president or get a Broadway musical made about you, you know, what are you doing? But there were so many people in every one of those early states that were doing so much. And George is one, and Lyman Hall is one. And they were active throughout the Revolution and beyond into our early federal period, building a new country from the ground up. And doing all sorts of different things. That's, I guess, the thing that fascinates me most is how they managed to make do and do as much as they did to make their own way and put together all the pieces.
George Walton also had military experience. He served, notably, under the command of General Robert Howe. And this was during the December 1778 capture of Savannah by the British. And during that fight, defending the city of Savannah, Walton actually takes a shot to the thigh and falls from his horse. And he does live, but he ends up being captured by the British.
And while Walton is being held as a prisoner of war, Lyman Hall has dangers of his own back at home. By the beginning of 1779, the British have set fire to Sunbury. The town, such a crucial part of Georgia's early history, is quite literally going up in flames.
When Sunbury's burned, Lyman Hall and his family flee. They get out of town. They head back north, and they stay there until the end of the Revolution. Walton, though, is at this point a prisoner of war, and he's released during a prisoner swap in 1779.
So, The people in Liberty County, as I said, were still very much in the thinking of a lot of New Englanders. And so they become attracted to the protest against Britain fairly early on. In Georgia, being the youngest, having a governor, James Wright, that they liked, there's a little bit of hesitance. When Georgia's Provincial Congress met in 1774, they voted to send some people to the First Continental Congress, but that vote was not confirmed by the Georgia Assembly, and so nobody went. So they hold a second Provincial Congress in 1775, and once again, they're going to choose people to go to that Continental Congress, but in the end, the governor dissolved the assembly. They didn't choose anybody, and Midway, the area that Lyman Hall was from, said, "Well, we're sending somebody on our own," and that's how Lyman Hall got up there. When he arrived at the First Continental Congress, he did not even vote, because he was not sent by the whole state. He had not been elected by they're still colonies at that point, but the whole colony had not voted for him. And so he's there. He expresses an opinion, but he's not a voting member of the First Continental Congress. So they finally have another provincial Congress. And by this time, the revolutionaries are beginning to gain power in Georgia. By 1776, of course, the royal governor is going to be house arrested, and Ransom can talk about George Walton's part in that. But he ends up on a ship out at sea and eventually leaves. And so when it comes time for the Second Continental Congress, where by the spring of 1776, they're talking about independence. And of course, some of the people involved in the protest are going to not participate after that. They thought that was a line too far. But Lyman Hall and Button Gwinnett went in May to the Continental Congress. Walton comes a couple of months later, and they're about to vote on independence.
Even after risking everything during the Revolution, neither man's work was finished.
One of the significant things both of them were involved in after the Revolution is the founding of the University of Georgia, of what became the University of Georgia. And a lot of those New Englanders were, because they bring that education tradition with them. And so I think that was a very important thing, because they're thinking, we're not going to have people born to be trained to be in the House of Lords, even in the House of Commons. We have to have our own citizenry educated and leaders among them who can be senators or representatives or judges or whatever. And so we've got to have a place where we're going to educate our young men at that time. Well, not totally. Oh, yeah. There were female
I was going to say, George was also a trustee of Richmond Academy, which is the fifth oldest public school in the nation. It is, still has students today here in Augusta. And I was actually abstracting the records from the trustees, and they chartered that school in 1783, and they had public examinations. So imagine taking your spelling test out in front of the whole town. And they recorded in the minutes of the trustees who had done the best in those public examinations. This was in 1786, I believe. And one of the best was a little girl named Sarah, which means not only were they educating young women, little girl, and again, this is, the essentially primary school age. They are not only educating women, they're getting the same. She would not have done the best in those exams if they weren't getting about the same education as the boys. So George was the...
They got some of the same. They didn't, when they get to Latin and science and that kind of thing, they don't think smaller female brains are really very good for that. But at the college level, it's going to be years. 1836 is the first college level in Georgia, and that's Wesleyan, which of course is still a college there. But yes, and especially women of more elite families, they were expected to have the basics. A lot of them learned French as well, because that was considered to be polite. But I just think it's interesting that both of these men are part of that movement for education after the war.
For Hall, independence wasn't the finish line. It was actually the beginning of the work. It was the beginning of building a new state.
Lyman Hall didn't serve in the military, but his contributions to Georgia after the Revolution are still pretty substantial. He becomes governor in 1783, and while he only served for a calendar year, he makes that year count. Lyman Hall was a big believer in education, especially in post-Revolution Georgia.
A lot of people in the state, including him, are really big advocates for a public university. You have Joseph Happersham. You have Abraham Baldwin. Lyman Hall's yet another one. They really believe in the value of being able to get a public education. And Lyman Hall really laid a lot of the groundwork for that when he was governor. That year as governor also had some challenges. Treasury is empty. The state has no money. It's bankrupt. And he's got to navigate the state through all of these issues.
The other issue he has to deal with is with the Georgia frontier. Away from the coast, Georgia is still wildly undeveloped. And in the rural wilderness, there's still a lot of fighting going on between indigenous Native Americans and loyalists who are still holding on after the Revolution. His governorship means he has to help navigate all of that.
And I think we don't quite realize how prominent George Walton was in his day. You run across things where it's history is about putting together a puzzle. And so we're always trying to find little clues and things that give us more context. And when George Walton passed, his obituary was bordered in black. It was very large, very prominent. And the only other time they had bordered, from the references I found and what I can figure out, the only other time they'd done that was for George Washington, when his passing was noted here in Augusta. But it gives a context for how well known he was in his day. And we don't really remember him that much today. Most people ask if he's related to Walmart people. But he pulled himself up, took advantage of every opportunity, which is sort of our American dream, that sort of pursuit of happiness ideas, that we can all take advantage of everything and make the most of it, whatever we have. And George definitely did that. He made the most of every opportunity. He survived lots of all sorts of political infighting and back and forth and round that was early politics was not for the faint of heart. And he survived that constantly in service, again, at local, state, and the national level, always doing something right up until his passing. He was involved. He was involved in the trustees of Richmond Academy, the trustees of Franklin College. He was a judge, a circuit court judge. Somebody resigned as a senator. He filled in the last 2 months or so of their term. I think it took him 3 or 4 weeks just to get up to Philadelphia, probably. And he filled in just this little bit of a term. He obviously had a heart for service. He took advantage of every opportunity and made the most of it. But he is quite a character. A huge emphasis on law in early Georgia. He was, one of that first chief justice, a circuit court judge. He was so involved in the foundations of our government. And yet he was definitely making the most of everything and quite a character, quite a story, and just reminds us to explore history and look for all these good stories. It's not just the big guys.
Right. I mean, everybody passed through there in some way.
There is a marker in Midway, Knowles Hall, which is for Lyman Hall, because that's where he lived when he was in Midway. So that's another marker, not on your list, but actually, directly related to what we've been talking about. And it might be interesting just to say a word or two about what the Signer's Monument marker marks and what's what it's in front of.
Well, sure, yeah.
It's interesting that in 1848, the same year day that the Washington Monument was being, kind of memorialized or beginning, Augustans had built this marker in front of their courthouse to the signers of Declaration of Independence. Well, they were dedicating it on July 4th. They had a big parade. They had a judge who spoke. They interred the remains of these two men. Button Gwinnett was, people weren't quite sure where, we're still not quite sure where Button Gwinnett was, somewhere in colonial.
He's been around a bit.
Yeah, he has.
Yeah, he it's always a thing with Button Gwinnett, it feels like. Indeed. But yeah, go ahead.
But Walton had been buried on his nephew's property near Turtnick Springs in Augusta. And so he was removed from there. Lyman Hall had moved to Burke County, which is the county directly south of Augusta's Richmond County. And he had a plantation there on Shell Bluff overlooking the Savannah River, and he had been buried there. So the two of them were reinterred here in Augusta, to great fanfare and parades and that kind of thing on July 4th of 1848. 176 years ago this year.
And it's definitely an interesting way to think about honoring someone, but then we do still know where they are. So often with family plots, you don't. So at least it's allowed us to keep up with them.
Right. Well, I have only been to Augusta a handful of times, and we were actually there not long ago shooting this episode. And we were right there at the monument, and we were shooting video and kind of doing our thing. And I couldn't help but wonder, how many people pass by that every single day and know that it's, a thing that is for the signers of the Declaration of Independence, but how many know that they're actually interred there? That seems sort of like a next, like a next level. But I just, because I was surprised when I learned that. I was like, wow, they're like right there in downtown Augusta.
They are. Now, as to how many people know, given the state of education these days, I don't know how many people know that. But certainly if they do school tours or you know, other
places. It's a hit on the field trips when we talk about, oh, wait, do you know that they're right down there in the median of Green Street? So, yeah. That is definitely one that we throw in on to let them know on the field trips. Oh, when you need to drive by so you can see the final resting place of two signers of the Declaration, it's right down the road.
One of the things I've enjoyed most about this project is discovering the stories behind names that we think we already know. Hall County, Walton County. Those names become so familiar that it's easy to forget that they actually belong to real people with really remarkable lives. Lyman Hall and George Walton came to Georgia from somewhere else, but they chose to invest their lives in this young colony and later this young state. They signed the Declaration of Independence, endured war, helped shape Georgia's government, and left a legacy that's still with us today. So if you find yourself in downtown Augusta, stop for a moment at the Signers Monument. It isn't just a monument to two famous Georgians. It's the final resting place of two men who were deeply involved in the architecture and the building of Georgia itself. Marked, the podcast, is written and hosted by me, Andrew Iden, and produced and edited by the GPB podcast team, Jeremy Powell, Miranda Hawkins, and Mark Davenport. And Sandy Malcolm is the Senior Vice President of Content.